We know that many congregations are putting together their budgets for the next fiscal year. Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. to your congregation's mission or advertising budget for 2009. Simply go to the sponsors page of our website, issuesetc.org, and find out more about the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues Etc. You'll even find a one-page flyer that you can hand out. Thanks for your support. Welcome back to Issues Etc. Our journey through the various worldviews, not all of them, but the major ones, and we're definitely dealing with a major one today, continues. Ken Samples of Reasons to Believe is with us for the remainder of the program. We're going to be talking about Eastern mysticism, or as he calls it, pantheistic monism. Both terms need some definition. It's Thursday afternoon, March the 26th. You can join us for the next 40 minutes of the program. 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943, or talkback at issuesetc.org, talkback at issuesetc.org. Ken Samples is Vice President of Theological and Philosophical Apologetics at Reasons to Believe, based in Pasadena, California, author of the book A World of Difference, Putting Christian Truth Claims to the Worldview Test. Best questions or comments from our callers or emailers, we'll get a copy of this book, A World of Difference, 1-877-623-MYIE, or talk back at issuesetc.org. Ken, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
When we think of Eastern mysticism, we usually think of the Dalai Lama or of other adherents to Buddhism, its close kissing cousin, Hinduism, elsewhere. Are these merely kind of localized manifestations of a greater worldview at work in a lot of this planet's inhabitants' minds?
Yeah, I think that's probably a pretty fair way of putting it, that, you know, you've got a lot of different Eastern religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Taoism, Confucianism, etc. I think that there is an underlying reality for many of those religions. Certainly Hinduism and a part of Buddhism and Jainism, they hold a pantheistic, monistic perspective, and that's what I'm trying to really capture in the particular chapter in my book, A World of Difference. It certainly would also carry over to what we experience here in America, the New Age movement, and that's kind of the underlining issue. Probably it best describes a philosophical form of Hinduism, but generically, it's kind of the granddaddy worldview of the religions of the East.
Why is this? I mean, I guess one thing that Western thinkers might find a little bit difficult to grasp is this other way of thinking. This one really is hard to understand for Western thinkers. It's almost like our minds are not wired to think this way about ourselves or the world.
Yeah, that's exactly on target. I'm teaching a course right now at Biola University called World Religions and Science, and you know we've talked about Judaism and Christianity and Islam and their attempts to relate to science and relate to the material physical universe. And the import of the course is how these world religions try to use science to justify their worldview. But I always have to tell my students that when we reach a point of discussing the Eastern religions, like Buddhism and Hinduism, all bets are off, because they have a way of looking at reality that is fundamentally different than the way we look at reality. Their view of religion is in some ways the opposite of the way we think about it. And so you do have to kind of get yourself to think differently in order to understand, so that hopefully, as Christians, we can communicate our faith to these people intelligently.
There was a tragic accident here in the St. Louis area yesterday, just last night. There were some students of a college, three females and a young man, all from students from India, who were in some circumstance I don't quite understand. Three of them were killed, if not four, and they were showing almost all night long on the news the I wouldn't call it a funeral or a wake, because although it looked like one, basically the various Hindu practices of saying goodbye to the dead. And they actually had, as part of this news package, translated from a Hindu priest, some thoughts. And the first thing the priest said was, well, you know, we hope by doing good things we will someday reach heaven. The goal is to reach heaven and then to be joined to the great oneness. And I thought to myself, well, I guess if I weren't paying attention, I might think that was some kind of peculiar form of Christianity or Judaism or even Islam. This concept of heaven, is it properly one of the Eastern mysticism we're talking about?
Well, I think probably the priest was kind of using language that might be more meaningful to people in the West by using the word heaven or the name heaven. But they have a very different idea. I mean, life is a cycle of rebirths. Being reborn is not a good thing. I mean, people in the West think, well, you know, if I live a couple more lives, you know, my next life I'll be the point guard for the Lakers, and they like that idea. But in Eastern mysticism, you're born back into the flesh because you've built up a karmic debt, and karma is a principle of justice. Your actions in previous lives reflect in the here and the now. I mean, one could probably draw the conclusion that if these people were killed here, then something happened in a previous life that affected them now. And heaven, if we're to use that term at all in a Hindu sense, means that we're going to become one with Brahman. That's ultimate reality. We lose our individual identity. The technical term is moksha, where a person becomes one with Brahman, and it's like a drop of water hitting the ocean. It loses all of its individuality. So there certainly isn't any personal conscious existence at that point other than being one with God. And by the way, we're already supposed to be one with God, but somehow we don't know that. So it's a very different universe to embrace pantheistic monism.
Okay, so the term God may be used, but it is an entirely different way of conceiving of deity, not the deity, but deity. Explain it to us.
Yeah, and of course, these terms are important. Pantheism, the Greek word pan means all or every. The Greek word for God, even in the New Testament, is theos. So pantheism it's defined as everything is God or all is God. And, of course, monism, we talked a little bit about monism when we talked about naturalism. Monism in this context would mean that there is only one reality. The reality is a seamless garment, and that one reality is God, that one reality is Brahman. And so everything, including us in the universe, are really in reality merely an expression of Brahman. And so this is a very different way of thinking about God than either Jews, Christians, or Muslims, or virtually anybody else conceives of God as being.
Okay, again, trying to wrap my head around what you've just said there. Is then all that I think is an illusion?
Well, that's the interesting thing about philosophical Hinduism, pantheistic monism. Sometimes they speak out of both sides of their mouth. Sometimes they would say that the universe, if you were to read the Upanishads, which are the more philosophical writings of a larger holy book called the Vedas from ancient Hinduism, they would say the universe is merely an illusion. Other times they say that the universe emanates from Brahman, not that God creates it ex nihilo, as we would talk about in a biblical context, but that the universe is part of God's body. And so as we put these ideas together, sometimes they are very conflicting, but fundamentally, there is only one reality. That reality is God. We have an Atman, a soul, or a spirit that is God, and so everything that is God, and there is no thing that is not God.
What's my problem?
Yeah, this is this is a good worldview way of thinking. What's the human dilemma? In a biblical context, it's sin. I have sinned against Almighty God, and I have broken His commandments, and I will suffer His wrath unless I have the blood of Christ to cleanse me from my sins. In pantheistic monism, the dilemma is that we suffer cosmic amnesia. We are, in reality, we are one with God, but somehow we have gotten it into our minds that we are somehow distinct or separated from God or apart from God, and therefore we have to regain that God consciousness.
And with about a little bit less than a minute before we take our first break, how is that done in a nutshell according to pantheistic monism?
Well, there are a number of ways in which you can change your consciousness and regain that reality that you're one with God. It can come through meditation. It can come through worshiping the various deities. It can come from practicing the principles of your caste system that you are born into, kind of a societal, cultural system that you're born into. And so there are a variety of ways of moving from an unenlightened consciousness to an awakened or lightened consciousness and realizing that you and everything else are God. So a lot of tolerance in terms of ways of getting to that goal.
This is interesting. When we come back, we'll take this up right here because to hear Ken describe it, again, it can be confusing because using terms like enlightenment or knowledge or realization, when in fact you go and talk to someone who is, say, a Buddhist or a Hindu, and they will tell you, well, yes, true, but for them, enlightenment means the loss of one's self, that knowledge means no longer aware of the self, or realization that you aren't. Very strange. All one thing. More on this after a break.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Grief Counselors, a sign of failing?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the book on death and suffering entitled, How Could a Loving God?
Many of our churches are failing because of the loss of the biblical foundation, and I believe what are called grief counselors are a sign of that failure. Have you noticed that there's been an increase in the use of grief counselors when there's a major tragedy? I remember a news item about a local teenager tragically killed in a traffic accident. A few times a reporter emphasized that grief counselors would be available at the school the teen attended. In the past, people used to turn to their pastors for comfort and answers. But as the church has lost its biblical foundation, including compromising with secular ideas like evolution, it's no longer seen as able to give answers and comfort. Today, people, not knowing what to do, turn to secular grief counselors in a desperate attempt to get answers. The church needs to get back to the Bible, starting with Genesis, giving the true origin of death and suffering and the real hope in Christ. You know, it's Christians who should be the ones providing the comfort in times of tragedy.
The hope we have in Christ is powerfully portrayed in a DVD we're offering to you this week called The Last Adam. This is one of the last opportunities today for you to receive this great evangelistic tool, recounting Christ's death and resurrection. For your donation of any size, you'll get this DVD when you call toll-free 1-888-89-ANSWERS. That's 888-89-ANSWERS.
We know that many congregations are putting together their budgets for the next fiscal year. Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues, Etc. to your congregation's mission or advertising budget for 2009. Simply go to the sponsors page of our website, issuesetc.org, and find out more about the Issues, Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues, Etc. You'll even find a one-page flyer that you can hand out. Thanks for your support. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Eastern mysticism, part of our worldview series with Ken Samples. Vice President of Theological and Philosophical Apologetics at Reasons to Believe, based in Pasadena, California, author of the book A World of Difference, Putting Christian Truth Claims to the Worldview Test. Listeners with best questions or comments will receive A World of Difference. Give us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943, or talk back at issuesetc.org. Ken, you used some terms before the break, enlightenment, knowledge, realization. And one thing that could probably confuse people if they were to talk to, say, a Buddhist or a Hindu, they would say, well, yes, enlightenment, but not enlightenment the way you think about it. This really is about losing the realization, the knowledge, and losing the sense of self. So, again, we're kind of using Western terms to describe something that is really not within kind of the realm of our vocabulary, intellectually or linguistically.
That's very true. You know, often I will try to explain to my students that, you know, Jews, Christians, and Muslims have the goal of living eternally, whereas Buddhists and Hindus and Jains, they want to cease to live. And so having some kind of consciousness of being distinct from God or having a world filled with all kinds of different realities, that's a conscious state that you must give up. You must give up the self, and to be awakened or to be enlightened is to come to this kind of intuition or aha experience that there really isn't many different things. There's only one reality. That one reality is God, and you are God. And so it is an attempt to change one's consciousness. It is an attempt to become disattached from the world, and so when they, when Hindu philosophers, Buddhist thinkers talk about death and the afterlife, they're talking often about something that is counterintuitive to people who read and study the Bible.
Okay, you mentioned before karma, and you said you used the term karmic debt. We Westerners have taken the term karma and turned it into kind of a good-bad thing. You have your bad karma, your good karma. And your goal is to build up enough good karma that it outweighs the bad. But that's not the way the karmic wheel works for the Eastern mystic, is it?
That you're correct. The principle is called karma samsara. Karma is a principle of justice, and building up karmic debt is by actions that violate principles of justice. Now, there's no God who is going to stand there as a judge and weigh your so-called offensive actions. Rather, it's built into the nature of reality. And so if you do bad things in your previous life, inevitably in this life, you will face consequences for that. The term samsara is this cycle of rebirth. If you have karmic debt, you are immediately put back into the body again, reincarnation, to be placed back in the body again. And you want to break this cycle. Because when you break the cycle, then you can experience moksha and become one with reality and lose all personal distinctions. So reincarnation is not a good thing. And, you know, I grew up in the 1960s listening to the Beatles. George Harrison took a journey to the East, and he would talk about Maya. I remember not long before George passed away, you know, he was saying, I did something in a previous life to cause me to be a Beatle. Well, not long before he died, somebody broke into his home, his mansion in England, and stabbed him. Fortunately, he survived. But I thought to myself, I wonder if Beatle George would say, I must have done something in my previous life that caused this violent action to take place in this life.
So to properly understand karma as it really is in this Eastern mysticism, it's not a good thing, it's a bad thing, and it's not like I'm going to do good in this life so that in my next incarnation things are better off for me. I don't want to come back. I want to break this vicious, and I use the term there not just figuratively, this vicious cycle of justice that has me trapped if I'm an Eastern mystic.
I think that's accurate. I think that's an accurate way of stating it. It seems that our plight in this life is sealed by actions in the previous life. And so there is a type of determinism, if not fatalism, that is connected with this. Now, I have talked with Hindu and Eastern mystical thinkers and apologists, and they will sometimes try to assert that, you know, there is much more freedom in the context. But the more that I look at the system, the more it seems that people really are trapped in this system, to be born back into a lack of enlightenment, to be born back into a dark world, is seen as really a terrible experience.
It's a Sisyphus thing, isn't it? I mean, if you could draw a parallel to some kind of Western Greek mythology, it's a guy continuously rolling this rock up a hill only to have it roll back down on him every sundown and start all over again.
And what a stark contrast from what we hear from the New Age movement, where we'll have popular Hollywood movie stars tell us that, you know, I was a princess in my previous life. Nobody is ever, you know, really low on the totem pole. I notice when they talk about their previous lives, they're always some king or queen or, you know, superhero. But the reality from an Eastern perspective is this is a very dark period and a very troubling period, and one you want to bring to an end.
Okay, I got a question. If the karmic system of justice works on good and bad, if that is essentially the input that one can contribute to the system, so to speak, but there is no God running the system or overseeing it or who is its source, then how do I know as an Eastern mystic what's good and what's bad?
That's not an easy thing to determine. It seems to me that the way Eastern mystics speak about karma, it's almost as if it's similar to a natural law, something like gravity or something that is literally built into the system. And so you may come to a realization that you have acted unjustly by the repercussions, but unfortunately that would happen in the next life, you know, principally. So if I were, for example, Reinhard Heydrich, who was Himmler's mastermind behind the Holocaust, and I died, I would be hit with all of these acts of injustice, but I wouldn't know exactly why and what for, and there would literally be the question, but I'm no longer Reinhard Heydrich. Now I'm another person. So the question of sorting out justice and issues like that, I think this is a very incoherent system. If I were in India and the poor kids came up to me with their bellies swollen because they're starving, I don't know, would I want to help them? Because I might be messing up their karma. They have done something. They're suffering because they've done something. That doesn't strike me as the kind of charity that we believe is important, because humans have inherent dignity and moral worth.
Wow. I mean, worldviews do have consequences, and one shudders to think that if this Eastern mystic worldview would say, hey, let's not fool with someone's karma, the best thing I can do for that poor kid is just let the universe deal with him the way the universe sees fit to deal with him, there's not going to be a lot of charity.
Well, and I think the reality is that India is a country in transition. It is a third world country that has advanced enormously in terms of science and technology. There are lots of Indians who are leading physicists and engineers, but it is caught in a difficult situation because these scientists and engineers follow the principles of the laws of science, yet they go to the temple and are told the world is an illusion. So talk about attention. And the reality is, according to many of the missionaries that I've spoken with in India, most of the charity comes from Christian organizations. Most of the care given to the poor, the people who are on the lower bottom ladder of the caste system, are often cared by people who are Western and who are Christian.
Okay, but we're going to do another break. Let's talk a little bit about who, if anyone, ever achieves what it is the Eastern mystic hopes he will achieve? And if you have, how do you know? Or how would I know that anyone else has achieved this enlightenment?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, there's no assurance There is the belief, there is the hope, there are beliefs that these gurus have achieved it. There is the hope that people have experienced nirvana or have experienced moksha according to your particular religion. But there's no assurance that you are going to be able to do this. And I think Hinduism has very little hope, very little meaning and purpose at times. It is a vicious cycle and one that's very troubling.
We're talking with Ken Samples, Vice President of Theological and Philosophical Apologetics at Reasons to Believe, based in Pasadena, California. Part four of our five-part daily series with him on worldviews, struggling with the one that is our subject today, Eastern mysticism. 1-877-623-6943 is our call-in number. 1-877-623-6943. We're giving away copies of Ken's book called A World of Difference, Putting Christian Truth Claims to the Worldview Test. You can also email us on this Thursday afternoon, March the 26th, talkback@issuesetc.org. When we come back, we'll put all of this to Ken's Worldview Test. We've interviewed four members of the President's Council on Bioethics since President Obama announced his decision to allow federal funding of embryonic stem cell research. Dr. Robert George.
In all the talk about curing Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease and so forth, who's shuffled off the stage is the victim, the tiny embryonic human being who will now be sacrificed, treated as disposable research material.
Dr. Gilbert Mylander.
Science itself always has moral agendas at work. It's not as if it's value-free. If we suppose that it's entirely neutral with respect to moral questions, it's not.
Dr. William Hurlbut.
Bottom line is whether we as a society are going to endorse the instrumental use of human life at its earliest stages in scientific research.
And Dr. Leon Cass.
He simply said, I think this is the right thing to do. I respect your opinion, but there was no argument other than cures will be forthcoming. That's an argument that only shows a very shallow understanding of the moral question.
Defending life from beginning to end, issues, etc.
It's not about you. It's about Jesus. For you. You're listening to Issues, etc.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Are you uncomfortable with making an online credit card donation? Well, here's an option for you. Call me at 618-223-8382, and I'll personally take your credit card donation and process it for you. Hi, this is Craig Feidinger of Lutheran Public Radio. Call me today, 618-223-8382, and make a secure credit card donation to help support Issues, etc. 618-223-8382.
Welcome back to Issues, etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Ken Samples is our guest. We're talking about Eastern mysticism, getting ready to put it to the test. 1-877-623-6943 or talk back at issuesetc.org. So what can we say positively about this strange worldview, this strange but rather prevalent worldview?
I think that if we're in the business of trying to build bridges so that we can meet somewhere and have a dialogue and understand and then look at how Christianity differs from this worldview, it seems to me that there are three things maybe we could touch on. Certainly, people who hold a pantheistic, monistic view of reality believe there is some spiritual reality that is behind or undergirds the universe itself. Now, we would agree with that. Of course, our conception of what that God is and spirituality is very different. but we believe in a spiritual reality. Secondly, they believe in a sense of one or unity. That implies to me that they do care something about coherence. We would define unity very differently than Hindu thinkers do, but at least we can touch upon that one reality. And then lastly, karma implies a principle of justice. Now, I don't think their principle really is justice, but at least they care about it and they talk about it, and I think we can talk about issues of justice and how we violate justice and how we can come to some real understanding of how we can be reconciled once we have violated those issues. So there are things that we can talk about and say that at least in some respects we could agree and use it as a bridge for further discussion.
Is this pantheistic monism coherent? That's one of the tests that you lay up for a decent worldview.
And that's such an important test. It is a foundational test. Because a worldview that is coherent, it doesn't mean it's true, but if it's coherent, it may be true, and then we would have to apply further tests. But if it doesn't pass the test of coherence, if it ends up being incoherent, then it's dead in the water. It cannot be true. And here we have an enormous a problem that I don't think can be resolved for pantheistic monism. It is filled with logical contradictions. In fact, the system itself seems to be fundamentally coherent. It's not like there might be some difficulties on the periphery. Right at the core issues, there is a incoherence.
Can it explain reality as it appears to be?
Well, that's just such a difficult problem. I mean, Todd, you and I, we're sitting here, I'm in California, you're in Missouri, and we're talking about issues of philosophy and theology and the Bible. But if I'm to embrace a pantheistic monistic position, this is not reality. This doesn't correspond to the way most of us experience the world. And even the fact that you and I are persons. Ultimate reality, Brahman, he's beyond the categories of personal, he's beyond the categories of moral and immoral, rational and irrational. I think it's very difficult to think that this system could be both coherent and have some real connection to reality itself.
Then what about, and this is closely related, I suppose, does it correspond with the way things really do work, or the way reality is?
You know, I asked a missionary recently who was born in India, born into a Christian family, but he and his family had spent virtually their entire life carrying on a Christian ministry to mostly Indian Hindu people. And I said, look, I there's something I don't understand. I hope you can help me with. I said, look, How can India be advancing technologically? You know, a lot of the tech jobs have moved from America over to India. How is it possible that these people can, you know, have advanced degrees in science, yet believe the world is an illusion? And his comment was to me that he thinks you have to give up being a Hindu in order to embrace science, in order to embrace that there's a real world out here, that world can be at least partially understandable, is intelligible. He said that there are many people who have become agnostic about their Hindu beliefs because it's so foreign. You know, we talk about people going on to being unemployed. If Hinduism is true, all of the scientists are unemployed because there's no universe to study.
Does it, rather than simply talk about it in terms of satisfying some inner longing, because obviously for millions, perhaps hundreds of millions, it does, but can you live it, and does it really objectively address man's real problems, Eastern mysticism?
Yeah, I have to say that the scores, at the end of each chapter of the various major worldviews, I talk about test scores, and I try to be as fair as I can be. No worldview is without some positive elements. But pantheistic monism seems to flunk some of the most fundamental tests. One, it doesn't seem to be able to explain conscious reality. Brahman is not a person. Brahman is beyond all of these rational moral categories. I mean, Todd, you and I, we can think, we can reason, we can make decisions. We hold ourselves morally responsible. I don't know how that God could create something that appears to be greater than him. But we can even ask the question, is this workable? Does it really work? Well, there are people in the West who think that their New Age ideas work, but if we're to look very carefully at countries that have really adopted pantheistic monism, reincarnation, and these concepts, I think these countries are very tortured and the people are deeply oppressed. And so I don't think it works. And I think that some of the advance in India has been at the expense of Hinduism, not because of it.
Then I guess I'm seeing some kind of a parallel here with a subject we took up a little bit earlier in our series, and that is materialistic naturalism. It seems as though, oddly, Eastern mysticism, because it's also a monistic view, like naturalism is, suffers from the same kind of fatal flaws as naturalism, as different as they are in their various aspects. About less than a minute to respond.
Yeah, I think that is fair. Both naturalistic monism and pantheistic monism, I think, are ultimately worldviews that give you no hope. There are also worldviews that find it very difficult to explain human consciousness, human rationality. And people enormously need to know that their life has meaning and purpose. Viktor Frankl, the famous psychiatrist who went through Auschwitz, said that when people suffer without meaning, it ends in despair. And I don't think naturalistic monism nor pantheistic monism gives people hope, nor do I think that it has strong explanatory power and scope. And so I think these are very deficient worldviews.
Ken, we'll wrap up our worldviews series with you tomorrow. A conversation on Islam. What's on tap for tomorrow with about 30 seconds?
Well, you know, if you think about it by the numbers, Todd, the latest number I've heard, the number of Muslims living in the world is now close to 1.5 billion. This is an enormous religion. It is a religion that impacts us economically, politically, but it's probably Christianity's greatest competitor when it comes to a religious philosophy of life.
Ken Samples is Vice President of Theological and Philosophical Apologetics at Reasons to Believe, based in Pasadena, California. He's author of the book, A World of Difference, Putting Christian Truth Claims to the Worldview Test. You can find out more about A World of Difference at our website, issuesetc.org. Check it out on the on-demand page, issuesetc.org. Ken, look forward to tomorrow's conversation with you.
Thanks a lot, Todd.
It strikes me that both naturalism and what we've just discussed, Eastern mysticism, are not elaborate attempts to explain the world, reality, man's dilemma, but elaborate attempts to explain all of those things away. I mean, is it too much to say that they are both cop-outs? What's man's problem? Well, man's problem is that he doesn't really exist, but he thinks he does. That's an attempt to explain away the real problem. Now, contrast this with Christianity, if only as a worldview. Christianity looks clear-eyed, eyes open, at the real situation we find ourselves in, the real world, our real dilemma, the real God, as much of a problem as he is for us as rebellious sinners. Christianity looks eyes wide open at the world and says, we may not be able to explain all of it, but we're not going to explain it away. We're not going to explain God away, sin away, ourselves away, reality away. We're going to see what God says. Take a God's eye view of this thing first. It's not a pretty picture. But, of course, a God's eye view also includes his son, Jesus Christ, who is the real Savior of this whole mess. I'm Todd Wilkin. talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.